Hey guys, welcome to the OT for Life podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Putt, and this podcast is here to talk about all things occupational therapy. Today's guest is Grant Mitchell, the creator of the blog Millennial OT. In this episode, we have a massive chat about occupational transition, including his current transition from living in Minnesota to moving to Florida, going from new grad to full-time practitioner, and from working in mental health to now working in inpatient rehabilitation. He reflects on his own occupational therapy journey and how his experiences have influenced his views on the profession as a whole. For more information and links to the videos and articles discussed in this episode, check out the show notes, which can be found on my website, otforlife.com. If you're interested in occupational therapy, this is the place for you. This show aims to explore our profession by sharing who we are and what we do. Because for us, occupational therapy is more than just a job. Hi, I'm Sarah. Welcome to OT for Life. Welcome to the show today, Grant. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well because I have recently moved from Minnesota to Florida. So I'm experiencing a nice change in weather, so I'm doing well.
Of course, right? Not too much snow where you are now.
No, in fact, when I left Minnesota, I hadn't really had any major snowstorms. And then after we left at the beginning of January, it got really terrible in Minnesota this year. I think there's definitely a few records broken, and I missed all of it.
Yeah, what was it? The polar vortex and all that, madness that was going on.
I watched that from my phone in the sun.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're in a very kind of interesting place in your OT career and just kind of like your experience clinically so far, and that you're just kind of in this transition period.
Yeah, I think transition's a really good word. That one keeps coming back with all the conversations I'm having. So I graduated from the University of North Dakota with a master's in occupational therapy. And it was in some ways harder to find a job than I realized. There is a high demand for OT, but in high demand areas like skilled nursing facilities or traveling OT, you can, if you're willing to go to the job, you can definitely get an OT job. But say if you want to live in a certain area or a certain town, it might not line up with being a new grad and finding the job you want because of, I think there's a name for it. Is it called the experience paradox, where all places kind of want you to have 2 years of experience, but you can't find any good jobs anywhere to get 2 years experience very well? Mm-hmm. So when I graduated UND, I ended up doing my first work. I ended up combining part-time positions to work part-time in inpatient rehab. And then more of my time, actually, I was on a inpatient psychiatric unit. So I had my feet kind of in those very distinctive worlds of inpatient physical disability and inpatient mental health, and got to experience both of those at the same time. And I very much liked the psychiatric work in the unit. I thought that sort of fulfilled me. I felt valued in that setting. I felt like kind of who I was, the things I liked to do all came out really well. But having a child complicated things. So after about 3 years of trying to work and not have childcare, and my wife's at home and we're living 30 minutes out of town, we decided to move close to the in-laws, my wife's parents, and they're in Florida. And they said, "We're not moving up to Minnesota." And we realized our only real option was to move down to Florida, which may surprise you, but that wasn't my wife's first choice. For me, I thought that was a pretty good choice, but it took my wife a little while to warm up to it. And she actually was working on an associate's in a culinary program in Minnesota and in Minneapolis, or actually in St. Paul. And so when she finished that, we packed up all we could fit in our car. She took a carry-on and I forget what they call the other type of bag you put your clothes in and goes under the airplane for our daughter and her. And they took a plane down, and I drove with whatever we could fit in our little Hyundai Accent. And that's all we had. And we just packed up and we moved all the way down to Florida with the in-laws. And I found a job down here working full-time in inpatient rehab. So that is the summary of the transition. You know, big transitions from workplace setting to state, new grad to full-time OT transition, family transition. So really, yeah, transition all around. And I'm always, you know, now that I'm an OT, I'm always thinking about it in terms of occupational deficit and changes in value to occupation. You know, I've had to go from being able to write and blog and make videos, doing the kind of mental health OT I like, to in some ways having a hard time finding time for those things, living with other people. I can't get, you know, time for good audio and video making. You know, there's always a TV on. I can't get my own space very well. Now I work full time. In some ways, the pace of inpatient rehab is really fast, so it doesn't leave me any time to like write or journal or anything. I'm kind of just working from the time I show up to the time I leave. So yeah, a lot of transition. And about summarizes it in one word, transition.
Yes, I think that's a great word choice for it. I want to go back just a second. When you were working in Minnesota, you had two part-time jobs. Now, was that with the same company and you were in just different, call it different units, or were the two different companies and kind of two different sets of rules and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it was actually with the same hospital system. It was with the University of Minnesota healthcare system. So, and what was really nice about that is because I was working part-time in two different spots, but under the same healthcare system, I was able to be considered a full-time employee for the sake of health benefits, especially as, because as an OT, I am the primary income of our household, but also for healthcare coverage, that makes a big difference. And when I was looking at other jobs, I was able to find some jobs in private outpatient settings or different clinics that would have been good jobs, but they did not provide benefits for spouses or children. And so that is one other thing to add to it if you have kids or family. And bigger healthcare systems, you know, like your nonprofits or your big hospitals, especially in the metropolitan areas, typically will have more robust or bigger benefits packages when it comes to dentist, you know, optical, health insurance, life insurance coverage, etc.
Mm-hmm. So then how did you, like, did you always know that you wanted to get into the mental health setting or the inpatient rehab setting? Or was that just kind of, because I know you were kind of talking about job availability or maybe lack thereof. So was it just, it was available and you were like, sure, sign me up. I'm a new grad. Or did you always kind of have this passion to get into either or both of those realms?
I would say both of those things you just said at the same time. And I often laugh because when I'm working, I tell people I primarily wanted to become an occupational therapist because I think that it was decent pay. It was a moderate amount of education required without, you know, a decade of my life. I thought it was a pretty quick track. And I thought there was a lot of job availability and that it paid well. So I didn't really have altruistic intentions going into occupational therapy. I just kind of had, I need to get a job. Like if I go to college, I want to be able to have a job when it's done. And occupational therapy generally looked like something that was interesting. I would say that it was more about it being interesting for me than it was, you know, the altruism, the helping people aspect of it. But once I became an OT, I realized how much it's impacted my worldview, my paradigm of thinking, my identity, and I love my job. In fact, the philosophy of OT has just become a very deep part of who I am as a person and the way that I see the world. And so the same thing kind of occurred with that mental health position. I was really just looking for work. And I got the part-time position in inpatient rehab first, but that wasn't going to cover the bills. And so I was looking for more work. And when the psychiatric position was actually a 0.7 a full-time position. So that's kind of, it's not really full-time by itself, but in addition to the inpatient rehab work, it worked out to be full-time. Okay. So I was like, you know what? I looked at the job description. I was like, young adults, mental health, program planning. I was like, I could do it. I did a field work. That's really what gave me confidence is I did a field work in a state mental health facility in Washington, Eastern State Hospital. And having led group programming and individual mental health sessions there, I know I had the binders, the paperwork, and the skills and capacity to show up and do that job. So just like, yeah, I'll try it out. I was a little bit surprised to find how much it sparked a passion in me for mental health, for working with people in that need, their needs, and seeing the needs for mental health in the community. I mean, it also really got me started on the roots of OT, mental health and OT at in the roots of it starting early on. But mental health is a neat state because it has a more effective or a larger budget, say maybe more programming for mental health than do some other states in the U.S. And so there's also a lot of OTs. There's actually a mental health for OT group in addition to a special interest group within the state association. So there's a very strong presence of mental health purists, I would say, people who are purely OTs in mental health. And I think the relationships with those individuals also encouraged my passion for that subject. So that's kind of how I found myself suddenly really interested in the topic of mental health, occupational therapy, and healthcare.
Okay, so I have to be honest with you. I'm totally shocked to learn your kind of intro into occupational therapy because I know how passionate you are now about the field and about the profession. And the fact that you were like, oh, it sounds interesting. All right, yeah, decent pay. It sounds like a cool job. Like just kind of jumped in. I'm totally shocked to learn that.
I didn't even know what OT really was until like probably 6 months before I applied for the program. Really, it came down to this. I was following outpatient rehab and I was following a physical therapist in shoulder rehab. And the thing about that is there's even an article by somebody and it was talking about shoulder rehab burnout in physical therapy. I didn't know at the time, but really what I was witnessing was pretty much the most boring aspect of physical therapy. I mean, notoriously, shoulder rehab and physical therapy is one of the most sort of like tiring areas of practice. And so I was bored to death. And then when I was like following an OT, they were all over the place with people who were young and old and in between with strokes and Down syndrome. And they were cooking and exercising and coloring. And it was just so lively to me. I was like, I could do this without falling asleep. Now, working with physical therapists, I realize how dynamic physical therapy can be in given other settings. Mm-hmm. So it's not fair, but at the time, that's all I saw. And I'm really glad because, I've come to really enjoy occupational therapy. I do think in some ways, this is more my opinion, something I feel I noticed that people who have really high altruistic expectations can sometimes have a harder time having to wipe people's butts, help them get out of bed all day long, and in addition to that, deal with the productivity standards and documentation standards and the workforce realities of occupational therapy, which can not be fun. And for me as an individual, I was expecting it to be good work, and then it turned out to be something that I'm very passionate about and that I enjoy very much. But there's also a lot of other complexity that goes into the experience in the workplace from gender to, age to workplace setting as well that I can't really say my opinion holds true for everybody. It's just something I feel I've noticed here and there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of giggling to myself over here because I realized that we actually had kind of a similar entrance into OT, which is like, as you're talking, I'm like, oh my gosh, that was totally me. Like, I was observing other professions and I was trying not to fall asleep. And then I followed an OT and I went into like a pediatric gym, like sensory gym type thing. And my eyes just lit up. And it was just like, as you were talking about how lively and how energetic it was, I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I saw too. So, and I also was the same. I found out about OT and I applied within like just a couple weeks and started a program less than a year later. So I totally get it. Like I just like jumped in just like you did.
Right.
That's so funny. So as you were talking, it kind of just sounds like everything that you were getting exposed to, that's what started to like pique your interest into all of these kind of passions that you have within the field of occupational therapy. And I know for a long time, you have been extremely passionate about mental health and kind of all the aspects around mental health within our society. I thought it was really interesting that you were talking about, and maybe you can explain this, like as you were learning about mental health and kind of being a new grad and getting exposed to that practice area, how that then also tied back into what you were saying before, like the roots of occupational therapy. And so was that just kind of happening like at the same time, or like how did, I mean, you started working in mental health, but then how did your, like, how did it solidify that you really had this passion for mental health?
Yeah, with mental health and occupational therapy, again, getting interested in it, I don't know that I was ever so deliberate about my path in life, rather than just sort of always being a little bit of an opportunist. I haven't fought too hard for doors to be opened or closed, but my options have been limited, and I've always been grateful for that. I don't know how to describe it, but it seemed that there wasn't a lot of options ever, and so I've sort of just taken a step forward wherever I saw an opportunity, and then come to have really appreciated where I've ended up. And mental health is one of those situations. And then blogging and writing was maybe just kind of an interest area in mine that I sort of tied in my work with mental health. And here's a fun fact for you, is I was homeschooled until high school. I grew up in northern Minnesota, really out in the woods in Ely, and I was homeschooled, and I really was able to just spend my time outdoors all the time. And then the rest of my family really hasn't quite had that same experience that my other brothers and sisters and half-sisters, and I share no siblings with the same two parents, but there's a lot of mental health challenges within my family. And one thing I feel is there's a lot that contributes to that, but I feel like my experience growing up outside of the school system and being able to be outside had so much to do with my well-being. Whereas, and I feel if I had been placed in school early on or had a more troublesome experience growing up, you know, at least I had a pretty good home to sleep in for most of my life, and parents that said, you know, that they loved me. And I saw all these elements, and so that interested me. And then I got interested in writing and learning about what mental health really was. And so I'm sort of that personality that wants to know kind of the real meaning or the real thing behind the word mental health. Like, what does that really mean? I also really wanted to be, another thing that contributed is as a mental health practitioner in inpatient psychiatric work, I wanted to be evidence-based. So I began trying to look for articles and research on like what works and what doesn't for different populations. I was also working on a young adult unit, which there aren't many young adult specific units. So it was sort of an experimental unit at the hospital I was at that I was asked to start the programming for. And that kind of made it more exciting because I felt like I had more stake in the, I should say, the program development of it, which in some ways made me more invested. And then there was a robust or a large network of mental health OTs in Minnesota, of which one of them is Christy Hurdle, who is also an OT historian. She's participated in the recent Willard and Spackman chapter on the history of occupational therapy in the 13th edition.
That
is really cool. She was a really amazing individual to meet several times and talk to, and she connected me with many of the other mental health OTs in Minnesota. And so that's how I just sort of suddenly found myself involved in it all and really interested in the topic of mental health and OT. But as I started to dig into it more and more, I came across a lot of things I feel I didn't understand before. And that's part of why I sort of slowed down on blogging and not that mental health needs a lot of advocating, but one of the things I thought before or blogged a lot about was about how the mental health crisis in the U.S. And the more I studied really what mental health was and what the crisis was, I can't say that I even really have a strong opinion, but I do feel like one thing that contributes to poor mental health in the U.S. is also very negative media in general. And I think that also comes back to people blogging about the topic like myself. And so I decided I really kind of wanted to know what OT was at its roots instead. And so then I sort of slowly started to transition into maybe a big interest in the history of OT to really understand what it was I was talking about. Because I'd find myself saying, you know, is occupational therapy the answer to the mental health crisis? But then I would be like, well, what's causing the mental health crisis and what is occupational therapy? And those are two very vague things. So I found myself with a greater interest in learning more rather than telling everybody what they should do with their lives. And that was for me personally.
Do you feel like, because I know you just mentioned that you were working with the young adult population within mental health and kind of really helping develop that program. Do you feel like, because you are young yourself and you could like easily relate with this population, do you feel like that there was any sort of like correlation where you were like, hold on, I really want to dive in deep because I understand, you can relate age-wise to this population. Does that make any sense?
Yep, absolutely. To answer your question, you're wondering, you know, did I relate to young adults in the psychiatric unit that I worked on, or did I feel like being a young adult myself helped me in that situation? Absolutely. One of the things that made me really interested in that work was that all throughout all 6 years of my college years, from bachelor's to graduating, you know, with the master's of OT, I was always involved in university housing. So my first year as a student at my university, I was on the programming board, which had like a $40,000 budget to bring in speakers, to set up major events for the university. And then my second year, I was a resident assistant, and I did that for 2 years. And then I was a resident manager. And I was involved in a lot of different programming committees, boards, resident assistant committees. So I had sort of this background in just programming in general. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is picking a topic, a theme, a subject, figuring out what you need to set it up, whether that be plates, cups, paper, equipment, tools, and carrying it out. And so my experience in college working in the dorms with floors of patients, I'd already started to get exposed to patients who had depression, patients who were suffering from bipolar, patients with histories of abuse, and not patients, those were students at the time, I apologize. Students who had all these different issues. And so a lot of my programming was, sometimes my programming was about mental health. I'm pretty sure I did one board that was on like places along the university you can go for help. We always had to do something on the topic or the subject for, you know, where you could go if you needed help for mental health crisis or clinic visit. And so I had already had kind of this experience. The way I explained it was I already had this experience with trying to get people on my hall or my floor to come to a group programming event when they didn't want to. So stepping into a psychiatric unit, obviously a lot of people have depression and maybe anxiety. Definitely everybody pretty much has anxiety just because they don't know what to expect yet. And so a lot of people want to hole up and shut up in their rooms and kind of hide away. And so I kind of already had that experience of just interacting with people that age group to try to get them interested in coming to my group. And it's a very delicate balance. And honestly, there isn't a right way to do it because it's playing off of your personality. And what I mean by that is I have a relaxed personality. I have a specific strategy to get people to my groups, and that's to target those other people who will get the other kids to group. Because there's kids that if I walk up to, or I should say young adults, say, hey, do you want to come to my group? They would be like, absolutely no. But if another patient went up to them and said, hey, you should come with me to the group, they're like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was always really relaxed. I always had a real open door policy. Part of that was the patient population itself, but just kind of how I approached it. Now, there's other therapists that don't have that same personality, and they go find everybody individually, and they try to get them to the group. And so really, I think what's best is to have a mixture of those personalities as therapists to go address the different personalities of patients. But my personality, working with young adults coming from a history of being a resident assistant, definitely played into my passion for that young adult age range and the group programming and just getting people to come to a group, which really comes down to just seeing people engaged. I think that word engagement or diversion, just having their mind focused on something else besides their situation. And there's a time for reflection too. I don't mean to say that we want to completely distract people from processing, but there is a certain amount of bringing the walls down, the emotional barriers down, bringing the anxiety down just through engagement in occupation. And it's a real simple, in some ways, it's a very simple thing when you see it happening in front of you, but it's really hard to describe it with words. And that's, again, kind of leads back to my interest in the history of it.
Right. That's exactly what I was thinking when you were saying
that. I'm going to stop there. Yeah.
I got you. Because I was actually, I had seen it before, but I wanted to rewatch it before we chatted today. But I was just watching your video, like the little, I think it's like a minute long, about kind of a short snippet of the history of OT. And they were talking about, you know, how it kind of evolved with the wars and then the soldiers coming back with shell shock and all these other things that they were going through and dealing with coming back from war. And I think one of the terms that you used in the video was they, or it might have even been in like an article that you were referencing in the video, was that they were calling it like distraction from everything that they were going through. And I just thought that was fascinating because on the surface, it might look like it's distraction, but there really is so much more at the root of why people are engaging in the activities that they were having them do. So maybe you could talk a little bit about maybe that video and kind of what prompted you to do it and what it means to you.
Definitely this comes down to, you know, the value, the occupational activities that I find value in, which is writing, learning, reading, and video making. I like actually editing. I find joy in clipping, making snippets of clips together. So that's kind of brought me to my whole interest in video, and video as an outlet for my interest in expression of history of OT. But in the process, really, I don't know how to describe learning about what OT is and the history of OT, except for sort of mind melting. It really has to kind of, in my opinion, at least my mind has to really, it really had to, in some ways, be broken down at the very root of worldview. Like, this might sound a little too much, but in some ways, how you see occupational therapy also is highly related to your view of who or what or if there is a God. And that sounds really, that might be getting really deep really fast, but occupational therapy is at its root such a paradigm and view of seeing people that the language occupational therapy as an idea starts to transcend language itself. And what I mean by that is I really had to learn about the difference between descriptive and prescriptive ideas of language. That's whether or not an idea, like somebody who is maybe a real English nerd will say you can only use a word this way and it's only ever meant to be used this way. But somebody who believes in that like words change throughout time kind of start to realize that there's always like these ideas and words help us attach to those ideas. And occupational therapy is one of those. And when you go back and you look at the start of it and the history of it, there were so many words thrown out. And I did this one video called 37 Names That Occupational Therapy Almost Could Have Been. I think one of the biggest elements missing in occupational therapy, or synonymous with our idea and our vision of what occupational therapy is the words distraction and diversion. And those were really heavy in the literature by the founders. The idea of it in the early 1900s was largely focused on distraction and diversion. And you know what? I haven't gone too deeply into this, but I'm going to throw a guess out there that America has a very productive culture. We place a lot of value as Americans, or at least as middle class Americans, or at least, you know, in the literature or the broad spectrum of what America is, in productivity, in accomplishment, in factory productivity lines and factories. And so I think diversion and distraction have developed a stigma over the last century that has made, like, if you go to work and you tell your coworkers, I'm just distracting my patients, everybody's going to say, what are you getting paid for? And that's kind of sad, right? But distraction and diversion, those two words were really important words at the beginning of OT. And I really believe they should still be. How about this? Yesterday, I'll give a real case example, even in inpatient rehab, working with this guy from Cuba, and he's very what we call hemi-affected. So pretty much one of his arms doesn't have really any working muscle at all after a stroke, and his leg can barely have him stand up. The facility that I work at very much values NDT-based treatment. That's standing, reaching, looking for just certain motor movements and focusing on what they call function, and that's really trying to get proper movement in the body to transition towards functional independence later on. So, you know, we're always doing reaching and grabbing. And he just, I felt like this element of sadness about his situation. I mean, there is, he's stated it. And I learned that he liked to play dominoes. And so I was like, well, let me go find some dominoes and we'll stand up and I'll just have you do some dominoes. So in a way, it was pure distraction just to have him stand and kind of reach for the dominoes, you know, turn the dominoes, flip them over and start a domino train. But in that moment, there was that clicking moment where that distraction and the diversion was something valuable to him. And there's a million theories to talk about it, but they're different words trying to describe a phenomenon that just transcends all these ideas. And I got to see him in that moment with his eyes, not sort of wandering around the room, not looking sullen, but kind of focused on the task while we were working on his motor movements and his standing and his reaching. And so distraction and diversion, I think, get a real bad rep when they're such a valuable component of what occupational therapy is.
Yeah, you know, and like as you were talking, I was just kind of like reflecting on the words of distraction and diversion. And maybe to somebody who doesn't put value on, like, let's use the example of dominoes, the story that you were just talking about. If you are not passionate about playing dominoes, maybe you've never played before, you played and you're just kind of like ho-hum about it, you're not very interested in it. If somebody was to tell you, okay, you're in therapy, now we're going to play dominoes, you'd kind of sit there and be like, well, this is silly. Like, what? This has no meaning. This has no purpose to me. But for your patient, that was something that was so meaningful and so purposeful that the second that probably he even saw the dominoes, like you bringing the box in and showing it to him, all of a sudden that the brain has this different reaction to it because it's something familiar, it's something meaningful. And then it just kind of ebbs and flows into this whole just natural kind of therapeutic environment. And so I guess what I'm trying to say by that is that the term distraction and diversion probably depends on the person. Whereas if you don't like dominoes, you're going to think it's a distraction. But if it's something that you do like, it's not. I mean, that is completely like 100% therapeutic there.
And here's a paradox for you. If occupational therapy is supposed to be different than physical therapy, but you have a patient who is a retired physical therapist and her meaningful activity is mobility and leg exercises.
I see where you're going with this.
This is a true story, a true scenario that I recently had probably 3 months ago now, 2 months or 3 months ago. I had a retired acute care physical therapist, and everything she said and thought was in terms of mobility, mechanical leg function. That was who she was, and it wasn't my place to change that. So we ended up focusing a lot more on mobility and moving and walking, because that's what was so important to her as a meaningful activity as a physical therapist. I laughed with her on the irony of that situation. But yes, absolutely. I think, and that's in some ways where I think there's a lot of value in my perspective of OT history and my experience in mental health, patient rehab. I don't know that I could carry out inpatient rehab work that I'm doing now until I retire. I could do it, but I definitely don't find it thoroughly fulfilling in terms of my ability to do programming, group programming. I know they have a cooking group on our unit. Another OT does a cooking group. And I say that is a wonderful example of the kind of programming that I find value in. So I could probably bring in group. I don't want to sell myself short this early in my career and say it's not fulfilling. Like, I have work to do in this setting to bring in those elements I find important, which is that mental health component. It is that interest in the history. It is that video making, if that's what it is. So there's no excuse for me to say that this inpatient rehab work is not fulfilling, even though it's not exactly the way I want it to be. Granted, in my head, I think some kind of more academic work, maybe more presentation related, and maybe more community program is more fulfilling for me. That's what I imagine in my head. I might not be ready when I get there if I ever have the opportunity to do that, if I don't learn how to step up to the plate here in the inpatient rehab. But I definitely get really excited on that topic. I just get really excited, which is why I start to go on a tangent. I have a hard time trying to stay on topic.
That's okay. Well, we're going to keep jumping back to it. So hopefully you'll be able to say everything that you want to say about all of your passions here. But I think, again, like right now, as you're talking, I'm like, the whole word of transition comes back. And here you are going through this huge transition from what you've known, living in Minnesota and working in with the mental health, working with inpatient rehab, and then you move. And all of a sudden, everything is different from your house, from your city, from your work. And I think earlier you were talking kind of about this disruption of routines, right? And that's basically what you're going through, or I should say you have been going through for the last couple months. And sometimes you almost just need like a state of consistency as you go through kind of these hard transitions. Because at least for me, because I just went through this myself, I just went through a move. And like, it's crazy because sometimes you just need that constant in order to get through all the routine or all the differences, everything that you're experiencing. And then once you kind of get that under your belt, then you have the kind of the mental space and the mental capacity to then continue on, or even maybe adjust where you are going with the blog, with the writing, with the videos and all of that kind of stuff. So maybe this was just your portion of like, okay, I'm gonna jump into this inpatient rehab job that I'm in right now, and I'm gonna figure out what's going on there and then be able to move forward.
Yeah, and you know what's coming back to mind is the OT practice framework and the use of those words like habit, roles, rituals, routines, which you know about. I think something a lot of OTs or probably any healthcare profession can forget to do is think about their own health in the same terms that they think about it for other people. It's like here, they always talk about the doctor who smokes because they're so stressed. And as occupational therapists, you know, I think we very much understand how much our roles, routines, our habits, and our rituals have on people's lives. But I think sometimes we forget how that influences us too, or at least for me, it's been a big recognition of how quickly I'm influenced by transition and change in my life. And I just, oh my goodness, there's a lot of transition for a lot of us. First of all, in the US, people are usually pretty young when they're graduating school. So they're transitioning workplace, setting states, moving from families. If you're getting married, that's a transition, trying to live with somebody else and learn their life routines. And so for me, yeah, it's been a lot of change. It's been constant change. I haven't lived anywhere for more than 1 year since I was maybe 16 or 17. And everywhere I've been moving pretty much every year of my whole life. And it impacts everything. From being able to exercise the way I want to exercise. I used to like to exercise a lot. And then when it's winter and you live far out of town, you don't have childcare and you work all the time, now I can't exercise. And another one is, you know, blogging and writing. Well, if the computer isn't set up in a place where you can access it easily and write, all of a sudden that gets in the way. Video making, maybe I could just get over myself and just take video, but I'm always so interested in the sound quality and the audio that I can never find good place to edit if we're just moving. And here's another one too. I thought you'd think moving down to Florida, it's sunny, right? You're going to start losing weight. That's what I had in my head. I should maybe not complain at all, but I still, you know, want to thin down a little bit, work on the beach body here in Florida. And I started gaining a lot of weight when I moved down here for the first 2 months. I would not have guessed it, but between my in-laws who are always feeding me, work, when you're in occupational therapy, either nurses have cookies, your coworkers have cookies, or your patients are cooking cookies. And church is always giving out like free donuts and cookies and all sorts of different things. Mm. I honestly was around, I'm around a plate full of cookies like every single day. And it's been so hard for me. I'm getting better actually. But my health routine has been maladjusted in it. And I have a hard time not eating cookies in front of me. If they're on a plate, I have a real hard time. I think about them. I want to eat them. So I've had to figure out new routines, like, you know, not having cookies in our house and trying to drink coffee and skip them at church and trying to not go to that side of the office at work and just trying to do a whole bunch of different things. So I'm not like literally eating 5 to 10 cookies every single day. Like it was really bad for a while. So transition, that is really a good word to describe it all.
I was just going to say, like, I feel like what you're saying is so easily translated for our clients and for our patients, because they deal with something that disrupts their routine, whether it's an injury, whether it's a disease, whether it's some sort of illness, something like that. And then all of a sudden they're faced with all of these potential triggers. I'm calling the cookies these triggers, right? These things that kind of pop up in front of them as they're facing this difficulty, this transition period. And like, as you're talking, I'm like, this is exactly what we are helping our clients go through and helping them identify where they're struggling and really kind of how they can get to make progress and reach their goals.
Yeah. Here's something I feel a little bit passionate about. I want to be careful how I say this, but I largely disagree with the cognitive behavioral therapy paradigm of change. That's that the way you think about things. I think there's value to it. I think it's a useful tool. I think it's a poor paradigm for seeing individuals. I think occupational therapy offers a better paradigm. And I use this word paradigm a lot. If people aren't familiar with paradigm, probably the best way to think about it is like, I think the common examples I hear is like the glasses or the lenses you look through, or if you're looking outside, the paradigm is the window. It can kind of give it different shades. I sort of think of paradigm as the big worldview, the thing that influences the way you see the world. And there's a lot of examples of that. You know, if you watch YouTube videos or TED Talks, you might find somebody describe it better than that. But it comes down to this: working in psychiatric healthcare and inpatient psychiatric healthcare, I was shocked at how intelligent and how well-educated and how practiced the young adults I worked with were in pretty much every form of coping skill. You talk about mindfulness, yoga, deep breathing, sensory techniques. The people I worked with could teach me more than I had to teach them. And they were doing everything. They were doing the deep breathing, the yoga, the getting up, and they were still struggling with depression. Well, you know what? I came to realize, I personally believe that we do not place enough, as a culture, enough value on circumstance and in that transition. For a lot of people, not having a place to live and having their boyfriend break up with them were really probably the most common, I said anecdotally, walking around. Those are the two things that showed up pretty much like all the time with the patients we were getting. You know, not having that social support and not having a place to live or having to move, a change in those big, those are huge changes. But a lot of people are also, I mean, if we're going to get serious, a lot of people are rape victims or abuse victims, or they've had family members die or loved ones. Those are so circumstantial that I don't think some of those things are about not having the right coping skills to deal with them. I think a lot of those things are about having the supports and environment in place to help us deal with those. So if people have poor social supports, poor engagement in activity, and then those huge life transitions on top of it, it's just a recipe for disaster. And I don't think there's any amount of coping skill. One time I said that and somebody said, that's really depressing. You mean to say there's nothing I can do about it? And I was like, well, no, that's not exactly what I mean by that. I don't mean there's nothing we can do about it. I just mean that I think our worldview thinking we can solve are the emotional, I'm talking about the emotional experience of bad life transition purely with increased use or better use of coping skills. Those are wonderful things. I just don't think those are enough to deal with really serious life transition. I think on top of that, we need the paradigm of occupational therapy, which is this idea of what you said earlier, rituals, routines, roles, habits, things that we sort of call familiar. And in a lot of ways, social supports, family is that familiarity. And there's a lot more that goes into it because some people just don't have that. They don't have that family. Maybe if eating dinner every night is a wonderful and therapeutic experience for one person, it's completely stressful and full of fighting in another family. So it's really just it's really complex, I think, is what it comes down to. So there you go. Got me off on another tangent.
It's almost like I feel like when you're talking about like the coping skills, it's almost just like, here are the 10 things that you do when you are feeling stressed or when you are feeling depressed or when you are feeling anxious. It's like, here you go. Here's your handout. Remember to do this. Okay, let's walk through. How do you take a deep breath? How do you do all of these things? But really, it's not just that. I think the more important aspect of it is, and again, like I think that paradigm, that lens that you're talking about is really helping the patients become more self-aware so they can identify what's going on in themselves to then be able Absolutely. To figure out how to address it rather than, oh, you're depressed, here you go. It's like, wait, hold on. Why am I depressed? What's causing it right now? And then what can I do about it? And not just kind of this blanket prescriptive activities to help somebody, that they really have to kind of be at the forefront of their own identity and what's going on with them in order to make a change in their behavior or their emotional status.
Absolutely. And I think a big value of kind of walking with patients through that experience of self-awareness, like you mentioned, is that I think a lot of times it's hard for somebody else to hold the answers for things that are so complex with the individual. Because if I go and I tell everybody that coping skills aren't the answer, you just need to have better social supports, somebody else, one of those people might be like, no, all I really needed was to understand that I'm highly stimulated by lights, noises, and I now that I know those things, I just need to avoid those things. Or if those things happen, I have strategies in place on how to deal with them. So I can't, you know, just say a blanket statement. Whereas if we're walking through self-awareness with people, it gives them the opportunity to be the agents of change in their life and recognizing what does work and what doesn't. I think one of the ways that we can do that as practitioners, something I practice a lot, is I think sometimes what I witness myself, what I witness other people doing, is maybe giving positive feedback to people going through a tough time. Somebody says, I want to kill myself. I mean, I hear this. This is something that shows up in the workplace. It's not in psychiatric, but in inpatient rehab. Like, I wish I was dead. I hear that here and there. Like, that's not an unknown phrase. It's not rare that somebody says, I wish I was dead and that I hadn't lived through this stroke. I wish that they hadn't revived me after that motor vehicle accident. I think to stop for a second and say, I'm sorry, your life really sucks right now. It's terrible to be you. You're in a lot of pain. It's not fun to feel the way that you feel. And I'm in some ways making that worse by asking you to get out of bed and come exercise with me. And I'm sorry for that. But I'm going to do that anyways, because while I can't know that it's going to make you feel better, that's the belief that I hold, and we're going to try that. I'm going to listen to you. I'm not going to ask you to change the way that you feel, but I hope that you can at least walk with me or move forward with me, and then we can kind of discuss how you feel and what we can do about it in the process. But I'm not going to try and stop the way that you feel about it.
But again, like, that just ties right back into that self-awareness and letting people feel that they're validated. It's okay to feel that way. It's okay that you have this viewpoint of, I wish that it was a different way, because they are going through something that is painful. It could be sad. It could be like any number of kind of these negative words that you could throw in when you're faced with something unexpected. And it's okay for people to have that viewpoint. And I think a lot of times it's almost like in our society, they want it to just kind of be swept under the rug. Oh, well, okay, like, you had a below the knee amputation, but it's okay. Like, you're going to be fine. And it's like, you know what? Sometimes people just need to go through those emotions. And I think as OTs, we are really skilled in connecting with our clients and getting on their level, helping them feel validated, but then also helping them move forward and not just like letting them kind of sit and wallow in it, but saying, I hear you. I'm here for you. Now what? Where can we go from here?
Absolutely. I think that was incredibly well said. There's a fancy word, and at first it struck me as a very odd word. Charles Christensen was the first person who said it to me. And then I've noticed it in the in books I've read here and there. It's like one of those experiences where you've never heard a word before. And then once you hear it and think about it, you start seeing it all over the place.
It's like the, what's it called? It's like the, you buy a red car and then all you see is
that red car. Yes. The word is sacerdotal. And it's kind of a goofy word. It's a strange word, I feel like. Sacerdotal is that idea of kind of the intersection between this thing we call like the priest and the engineer, or like the priest and the doctor. And there's sort of an intersection between those things, you know, and that's addressed in all sorts of different words, whether you call that whole, holistic, you call that, you know, the mental health and the physical health. And when you're looking at somebody and you're addressing their experience and their emotions and then saying, where can we go from there? There's a discussion about their internal experience and then making the rubber kind of hit the road or moving forward in actionable steps. And I think a lot of professions live in one or the other realm. Like they're either like, okay, here are your medications, let's go. Here are your symptoms, this is what we're going to deal with it. Or they're like, how do you feel about that? Okay, now how does that make you feel? And they're like, it makes me feel bad. I still feel bad. And some people want to talk about it, but it's just like, they're like, occupational therapy just kind of provides that whole spectrum, I suppose, of taking somebody where they're at and just moving, just doing. I tell people, I think occupational therapy is most synonymous with doing. That's the most vague word that I think best reflects occupational therapy is doing. But, you know, that could change too.
Of course, right? It just give it a little bit of time and that could change into something else. But yeah, I mean, I definitely think that doing is a very strong word, but there's so much more to then just the doing, because you have
absolutely
the mental aspect, you have the physical aspect, you have the emotional aspect, you have the social aspect, you have the environmental. I'm like, I know I'm forgetting some here, but you have all of these things that kind of can tie in and like spiderweb out of that doing. And so like it's so hard to just take one word and say like, this sums it up. And we're like totally jumping ahead because
right.
you know what my last question is going to be.
I was thinking about everything we said so far, and I was just seeing this theme that in our discussion, it's that life is full of transitions, and focusing on the mental or the physical aspect of those transitions alone often isn't enough to deal with it. And occupational therapy is special in that it offers the full spectrum of change or a way to view the whole picture in a lens of occupational therapy, whether you call that habits, roles, or routines, or some people would call habits, roles, and routines a very maybe Western way of perceiving it, in that you have the Kawa model, whether it be the river and you know the things that are blocking the flow of the river. Occupational therapy is not really exactly the model, but it's just that it's starting with the self-awareness of zooming out of your life and kind of recognizing what's going on and then taking steps towards change in doing. And a lot of times that's through occupation or through engagement in meaningful activity or simply our day-to-day activities.
Yep, 100%. I feel like for me currently, especially because I just kind of went through a big transition and moving myself, I've realized the importance of occupation in general, but also of meaningful occupation. And I've just kind of spent the last, I don't know, couple weeks really just focused on packing and moving and organizing and decluttering, minimizing, like all of that, which I know you know because you just recently went through it. And I felt like I really wasn't able to do a lot of the things that bring meaning to my life. I was just really kind of like going to work, coming home, packing, like waking up the next day, packing before I go to work. And that was kind of my routine. And finally, like today was kind of the first time that I was able to take a little bit of time for myself and like actually record a podcast, which I haven't done in a week or two now. I was able to go for a walk and I honestly feel so much better, even though I just had a couple short stints engaging in kind of these meaningful occupations that I really haven't been able to participate in within the last couple weeks. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's just, you alluded to it before in our conversation, but I think like we never shut off our OT brain. And I'm constantly reflecting on like occupational therapy and how they influence my life and the lack thereof, how that influences my life. And I just think it's really interesting on how I'm like always thinking about OT.
Yeah, absolutely. I call that paradigm, right? And that's where I was saying earlier, just how occupational therapy, while I didn't go into it altruistically or because I ever wanted to, I dreamed of it as a kid. Now that I am an OT, it's such a meaningful part of my life. It informs the way I see the world. And it informs my perspective of God, as well as it's highly related to the deepest perspectives I have on the meaning of life. And that's that, you know, occupational therapy is just two words trying to connect to an idea about humanity and what it means to be human and what it means to be alive. And I think occupational therapy may not always be perfect, and our profession may or may not always be called occupational therapy. It's hard to know what the future of it is, but the value is the start of it. The start was incredibly existential, in that the start of occupational therapy was an attempt to summarize the core meaning of what it means to be a human. And engaging in activity is what it means to be a human. A lot of other professions, I always like to pick on optometry for this, because I think we can all value optometry. So I don't think optometry is going to be offended. But and that's that they provide us glasses as well as our ability to see. It allows people to drive, allows people to reach there. Optometry is incredibly valuable. But, you know, at the start of optometry as a profession was trying to address a very specific need, and that is vision loss. And it's a very practical skill, whereas in it's not inferior or superior. I just use it to contrast what it is as a profession compared to what occupational therapy was trying to be at its start, in that optometry is trying to address a problem. Occupational therapy was as well, but it was also trying to answer what is the meaning of life. And it addressed it by saying, in a lot of ways, the meaning of life is doing. It is being engaged. Life is the living of life itself. And that's really, it's kind of complicated. It's hard. I think in some ways there is no answer to what is OT, because OT will always evolve and change to be whatever we are or however we are living. And that's the whole idea. It's us.
Yeah. And honestly, just to piggyback on that, I feel like occupational therapy depends on the individual and what they find meaningful and what kind of how they define their life. So it's kind of like a collective term of trying to pull in what everybody thinks and kind of deems the meaning, the true meaning behind occupational therapy. But it's also so individualized. And so it's hard to just pull it all together into like one word, because it is so broad and so kind of all encompassing. Well, you know what? I'm going to totally go out of order because we're here. So because we're talking about one word to describe occupational therapy, I'm going to throw this question out.
Oh, I'm super excited now. I'm getting really excited. We need a drum roll for this question.
Perfect. If I was really good about editing in sound effects, then I would, but I'm not there yet.
This is the question you ask right before a commercial break.
Yeah.
Yes. This podcast is brought to you and sponsored by. We will come back with his answer shortly. Right. After
you got to get like the Jeopardy music. Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
Okay. In all seriousness, if you could only have one word to describe occupational therapy, what would it be?
Doing. Definitely. Doing. But I will say this. All words, I think, to some degree, are different in everybody's minds. I always talk about with Chandler, you know, have you ever read the book? It's pronounced, I wouldn't have guessed it. It looks like it's pronounced Hygge, but it's actually pronounced Hygge.
Yes.
It's the Danish art of like homemaking. Mm-hmm. Well, he talks about how Hygge doesn't have a perfect English word, that it would be the best English words would maybe be like hominess or comfort, sort of like hominess. You know, if you think about what hominess is, you have all these images that come to mind, maybe campfire, maybe like, you know, low light, sun setting, maybe you're on the lake, or maybe you just have a fireplace. But this is what I think is ironic about saying that it doesn't have a perfect English word, is that he talks about it in his book, you know, was it The Simple Art of Hygge or something like that? Miek Viking, I think. He has a TED Talk too. But he surveys Danish people and what they think Hygge is. And they have all sorts of different opinions too. Some people think it's chocolate, candles. Some people think different things are involved in it. And so my question is, if Americans all have different opinions on what hominess is and what Hygge is, and Danish people have different opinions on what Hygge is, in some ways, nobody has this exact same opinion. We all have those different experiences. Doing for me, doing is an incredibly powerful word, because I have found that the word doing is associated with a lot of my deeper thoughts about philosophy, about the intersection between the physical world and what people might call the spiritual world, maybe the intersection between our subjective experience and our objective and the objective world. Doing, I find, is one of these middle words that somehow sort of pulls together both aspects of the metaphysical world and the physical world. So when I say doing, in my mind, doing is associated with one of the hardest things to understand about life, life itself, living, what it means to be human. And that is, it's hard to say, if you were to pause everything, let's say you could truly stop time, stopping time also stops life. Because if nobody's moving and thinking, they're not living, they're not moving. And that's a really weird way to think about it. But doing is itself the representation of the change that reflects what we call life, the difference between the rock and the dog that's barking. It's doing for me. So I find doing to be an incredibly powerful word, in that it's a word that helps me relate to occupational therapy and what that's trying to be.
Uh-huh. And this is exactly right why I ask this question, because you say doing in one word, and then you have 1,000 words to describe what doing means to you. And it's like, it's so hard to just put it all into one word, but you're right. Like, absolutely, doing is an extremely powerful word. And it's also something that somebody, that every person would have kind of a different meaning that they would attach to doing. Like, some people are going to think doing, right, is extreme physical activity and mountain climbing or riding a roller coaster or whatever. And then some people, that doing is sitting down and enjoying a cup of coffee and reading or something like that. And the doing, mm-hmm, could mean so many different things. And so I want to give you a little bit of chance, because I know you kind of mentioned it throughout the episode today, but you've talked about your blog and you've talked about the videos. And so I'd love to give you just a little chance to talk about what you have going on with Millennial OT and potentially maybe where you see it kind of morphing into, because I feel like we've been talking about this transition period and kind of how it's shifted your mindset and you've had some big reflections on it. So if you would just share a little bit about what is Millennial OT.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for having me come on. I have been running under the name Millennial OT now for probably about 2 or 3 years. And actually, before that, I tried a short blog stint called The OTpreneur. And yeah, I think I always had, I think whenever we start projects like that, we do have a grandiose hope that it turns into something amazing. But I've always held that for me, a lot of what I've done has been about the value of doing it. Doing itself, as in I like to create PowerPoints, nice, and there, videos and writing, right? Yeah. I like it's the means to an end, or the end is the means. I find the value in the means of, you know, it sounds simple, but like the website template itself is so fun just to set it up. I just do that for myself. But in the process of this, you know, Millennial OT started out with this idea that we're millennials, and I'm a millennial, and I'm an OT, and mental health is a very big topic right now. So I wanted to address it from an occupational therapy standpoint, but I also really, in the back of my mind, have one other thing that I want Millennial OT to be, and that I always wanted it to be well-designed. I've always liked aesthetic, you know, the millennial feel. You think about minimalism. I just think about like a lot of things on Instagram, photography, just the feel of beauty and aesthetic and trend. And I always wanted to bring that to mental health, make mental health topics trendy as opposed to boring. But now that I'm not a mental health purist, and now that I've changed my opinion about what the mental health problem is in America, now I'm at a transition phase where I'm finding personally more interest in the history of OT. I'm also finding more history in sort of existentialism, or like the philosophy, the deeper meaning of life. You know, I think existentialism is really just that idea of asking, what is the meaning of life? You know, what is the meaning of it all? What is the meaning of these questions? What is the meaning of occupational therapy? So I'm currently really in a transition phase with this thing called Millennial OT, where I don't know if that represents my blog or if that's just going to be the name I'm going to go by to represent the things I'm interested in. And that's the direction I'm going. So I apologize to anybody who is confused about what millennial OT is supposed to be, because I'm confused too. I really want it to be something that's kind of neat and beautiful, but also is related to occupational therapy in a millennial way. And I am finding more interest in history now. So I think it's going to transition that way. I've been making more history-related videos. Deeply, I think it's going to be just more on the topic of what philosophy of OT or what philosophy is in general in that topic. And it'll just reflect the kinds of videos and topics that I hope to get to. I mean, I'm still writing. I'm still taking notes. I'm still developing timelines and plans and goals. I just really haven't been posting. And I'm really not looking to develop a strong community around myself. I think I really just want to create content partly for myself because I get really interested in making videos. You look at the Bloom's taxonomy, puts creating really at the top, that you can learn all the knowledge and facts at the bottom, but then you have to analyze it and process it and synthesize it, and then you create a product. So for me, I think Millennial OT is now kind of a reflection of my learning process. And I just hope to not confuse people or lead people the wrong way now. And I'm hoping to find a better way to communicate that through the work I do or whether through my blurb on Millennial OT. And I'm going to kind of, I have the Twitter handle, the Instagram handle, you know, the Facebook page and the website. So I don't see a reason to try and reinvent a new name. But now Millennial OT is just now kind of a reflection of my learning process as a millennial, bringing in all these new topics that kind of interest me. And that about summarizes what it is that Millennial OT is for me now.
Which is perfect. I think it's really great that you're kind of changing and growing and learning and just kind of continuing the growth as you learn more, as you reflect on more stuff. I think it's beautiful. And I think as long as it's representing like what's true to you, that's really all that matters. And I think one thing that I've seen since we've met and since I've kind of been following you is that you have a very powerful way to shed light on topics that some people might kind of just brush aside, or they might think that it's boring or it's not applicable or something like that. And you have really kind of brought to light the historical side of occupational therapy, talking about mental health and kind of talking about these and showcasing these videos. And it really has just painted this whole new picture and really just like, it's amazing. I'll watch your videos and I'm like, oh my goodness, like this is so cool. But when I was in school, I was not really interested in like occupational therapy history. Like it just it didn't connect. And you have this ability to really bring about that connection and showcasing what our profession is. And I love it. So I'm super excited to see where your blog goes, where the videos go. And I just have to say thank you so much for coming on the show and taking the time to chat with me today. I had a great time. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's incredibly therapeutic for myself as an occupational therapy to feel validated. You know, and I think a lot of us as occupational therapists do struggle with that during transition, in knowing what is it that we do and what is it that we are a part of. I think being a part of a community, whether that's the podcast community or the Twitter community or the Instagram community or the Facebook pages, I think it's really important that we have some colleagues somewhere that we feel like we can have these discussions with, because I think there's so much depth to occupational therapy that I think it's just so important to be having these discussions. And so I am so grateful, Sarah, that you had me on here. And I am so grateful for anybody that listens to this, because you heard me go on a lot of different tangents and probably get very sort of like existential and metaphysical in the ways that I want, which could be very boring to some people, or maybe you might think I'm crazy now. But I appreciate anybody who has listened to this. I really like what you do, Sarah. And I think you're a podcast natural. I listen to a lot of different podcasts here and there. And when I hear you, Sarah, I really enjoy your voice. I enjoy the way that you talk to people. I think you're engaging. And I really hope that your podcast goes far and that you get a lot of really interesting people on your podcast.
Well, thank you. Pressure's on now. Now I have to make sure that this one turns out as well as you say the other ones have turned out.
Hey, before you go, I just wanted to say thanks for listening to today's episode. If you want to further the discussion, go to our website, otforlife.com, and join our Facebook group. If you like us, here are three easy ways to let us know. One, share our podcast with a friend, colleague, or anyone interested in occupational therapy. Two, leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere this podcast is found. Three, subscribe to us so you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. Thanks again. We'll catch you next time, OT for Lifers.
Oh, I don't hear you. We can just mime and assign this whole interview.
Now, I've listened to quite a few of your blogs or your podcasts. I haven't listened to all of them yet, but
well, then I can't talk to you right now.
I know, right?
You have to go listen to all of them and then come back.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Can you hear this?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just make sure not to do that. I'm sometimes in a deep sigh, or I'll have to make sure not to like blow on the mic. That's one thing that bothers me in podcasts when you hear people.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, I feel like I'm like going in circles here.
Right. Well, that's not your fault, because that last question, I realized I rabbit trailed a lot there. I talked about probably four or five different subjects when I should have just tried to stick to one.
Oh, no, you're good. I'll just come back if I need to ask another follow-up question.
Well, I'm glad to get a second chance.
Yeah.
So how's that for an answer?
We are really, what's the word I'm looking for? Hold on one second. Somebody's at my door. Can we just pause for a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, hold on. Okay, sorry.
Sounds like pizza or Amazon. So we were just finishing up just kind of about life being full of transitions. And I think you said you had one last question, which is probably about the direction we should move, because I've been talking your ear off.